Hi, we're Josh
and Arielle Wamsley,
owners of Green Valley Tree LLC, based in North Windham.
We're proud to sponsor Connecticut East this week and to serve the communities of Windham and New London counties with our tree removal and plant healthcare services.
Visit our website at greenvalleytreeworks.com for a full list of our services or give us a call on 860-234-4041. We look forward to hearing from you.
How do you transition from high school to college if you have a learning disability? We talked to local author and coach Jennifer Sullivan about her new book that has words of advice for diverse learners and their families. Plus a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. Navigating the journey from high school to college can be difficult at the best of times, so imagine if you have a learning disability too. Jennifer Sullivan is a local author as well as community and caregiver liaison at Learn in New London, which is a regional educational service centre for all learners in the community. Sullivan also has children of her own, one of them with a learning disability, so comes at the subject with a lot of knowledge. I caught up with her recently to talk about why she wrote the book and how she feels it will help. Jen, ever so many thanks for joining us on Connecticut East This Week.
Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about your background and also why you decided to write this book of yours.
Sure. So I am an educator with 18 years experience, mostly in higher education, but also in K-12 schools. My background really began 18 years ago living in New York City. I lived in New York for about 5 years, and I worked at a college there, the College of Mount St. Vincent in the Bronx, New York, and that's where I fell in love with working with college students. I was working with a really diverse population of students there, a lot of students, first-generation students, and so that's really what started my career in higher ed, then moved back to Connecticut. I'm from this area, graduate of Ledyard High School, and I was a founding member of a transition program on a college campus here in New London. And so that's really where my passion for working with students with disabilities and their families really started. So since then, I have really just been kind of honing my skills and just working with families and supporting them in the transition from high school to college, which is a big leap, you know, in and of itself from high school to college, but particularly for students that have learning disabilities or physical mobility challenges or mental health illnesses, it can be increasingly challenging for them in particular. So I really fell in love with, you know, working with families and students. And, you know, to be honest, it was my husband who really pushed me to write this book. He has said that people need to hear my advice and people need to hear the things that I say and the way that I uplift them and encourage them. So he's really the one who pushed me to get my ideas down on paper. And it's been a couple of years in writing this book, but I'm really excited, you know, that it came out last month, and I'm just excited to share it with students and families who can hopefully benefit.
We're going to delve into, obviously, the book throughout the interview. I just want to ask a few more questions of you and your background, because as you said, you know, you come from this area. It was always great when people, you know, come from southeastern and eastern Connecticut, you know, leave, come back, bring all this experience with them. You also work at an organization called Learn, based in New London. Tell us a little bit about that, because that's a unique organization, isn't it?
Absolutely. It really is. And it's an organization where I feel very much at home. Learn is a RESC. It's a Regional Education Service Center. They're one of 6 RESCs in the state of Connecticut, and they work with and support member districts. So Learn supports the 24, 25 districts in southeastern Connecticut. And I'm so proud to be, and really humbled to be a part of the Ocean Avenue Learning Academy. That is a school for exceptional learners right here on Ocean Avenue in New London, students ages 5 through 21. And honestly, I mean, the staff there are the most dedicated, passionate, and compassionate educators that I have ever worked with.
Now let's get to this book, because it is a great book. You said it came out a month ago, and I think you just said it took you about 2 years to do it as well. So, you know, researching, writing books, it is a big task. So why did you want to put all of that effort into creating this?
It's a great question. Well, I didn't realize it would be as much work as it was when I started writing it. So I started, like I said, about maybe 2 years, maybe even longer, maybe 3 years ago. And you know, it started with stories. These were stories of, well, the stories in the book are based on interactions and relationships that I'd had as an educator. And so I really felt that, you know, those stories and some of the ideas needed to be told. So, you know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I would put some, you know, some information down, I would do some typing, and then I would leave it. And then I would come back to it and add a little bit more, and then I would leave it. And I really have to say, because of kind of what's happened kind of in our world the last 6 or 9 months, because of that time at home, that was really the impetus for me to say, all right, Jen, you need to sit down, you need to finish this. You know, this is a great idea and people need to hear these words and can really benefit. So you just need to finish. And so I've really pushed myself probably the last 6 to 9 months to finish the book.
Now, one of the things when it comes to, you know, writing is we're often told about authors, you know, write about what you know. So clearly this book is, as you say, all about what you know from your years of experience as an educator, as a coach. But also Yes. There's another element to this, because you have a daughter with a learning disability. Did she have any input Yes. into this?
Interesting. She did not have input in the content. Because you know, she's in middle school right now, so she has not gone to college, so she wasn't able to help me in the writing of the book. But I did have her read over parts of the book just to get her thoughts, to make sure that the book was accessible. I wanted it to be easily, you know, able to be read by students. You know, I didn't want to write about pedagogy. I didn't want it to be complicated. I didn't want anyone to feel like it wasn't meant for them and that it was hard to read. So I did give it to her. I gave it to my older daughter as well, who's in high school, and you know, and asked them what they thought. And I think they liked it. Anything that they said, "Oh, Mom, you know, why did you write that?" You know, I took those things out. So it really helped give me a younger person's perspective. Yes.
Now, are there any particular sections, you know, of the book that posed, say, more of a challenge based, you know, on your experience and what it was that you wanted to try and get across?
Yeah, well, I think an interesting point, and this is something that connects to students with disabilities entering higher ed right now, you know, the trend, you know, in higher education is that more and more students are experiencing anxiety. You know, more and more students are entering college with mental health issues, and you know, and colleges do know this and they're being responsive to this. And so I think what makes the book unique and challenging, I guess, is that I wanted to include, and I wanted to be very intentional about including mental health advice and tips as well. You know, I'm certainly not a clinician, but to talk about, you know, helping students to reach out and to connect with mental health providers on campus, I think is really important. So I wanted to be very intentional, and I kept reminding myself to come back to that, to not include just academic tips, to not include just, you know, residential living tips or executive functioning tips, but to make sure that there were suggestions and words of advice to help students feel supported in their mental health.
We've already established, obviously, at the top of this interview, you know, your background and experience in working with students with disabilities who are going or transitioning to college. So what do you think is the most important piece of advice, or maybe the most important tip in your book that you give to new college students with disabilities and, of course, their families?
There are so many. I think every tip is really important. I would say for students, it's really important to be a self-advocate. You know, in college, faculty and staff think that no news is good news. So if a professor does not hear from a student, then they think everything is going well, even though the student may be struggling for a variety of reasons. So I think it's really important to encourage students to speak up and to practice speaking up, you know, in high school, so that they feel comfortable doing this. I think for families, the words of advice that I give the most are to be patient with their college student, but also to be patient with themselves. And I think this is something that is really unique to the coaching that I do and the support that I give to families, is that I'm not just a problem solver, you know, for students, but I really listen to families and acknowledge the journey that special education families and caregivers have, and that it's been a difficult journey and it's been complicated and it's been challenging, and that parents need to give themselves credit. Parents need to be patient with themselves and to take time to care for themselves as well.
Why is there, do you believe, so little information out there for parents and students with disabilities still, do you think?
You know, I think there is information out there. I think, you know, there are a lot of really great organizations that are doing really great things to support families of children with disabilities. You know, as anyone who, you know, who's in special education knows, a lot of times we're working in silos, and parents feel like they're the only ones. They feel like their child's journey is unique, you know, which it really is, but they have a hard time finding information. You know, there's not one clearinghouse of information, you know, for families, but there are organizations that are doing a really great job. And I think technology is really helping. I think it's really helping to disseminate information. In addition to organizations doing a great job, I think organizations are thinking innovatively and are hosting events that are really great resources to students and families. And I could talk quickly about LEARN, and because this event is really near and dear to my heart, this is something that I've been a part of organizing for the last 3 years. So my colleague, Lois Eldridge, she's the transition coordinator at LEARN, and she has been hosting a transition night for probably the past 10 years. So this is a night where families of students with disabilities who are getting ready to graduate high school and are going to college, she brings together organizations in the community that support these families and students. And she was hosting this at a local school, and a colleague of hers, Bill Donahue, who works at the Mohegan Sun, attended one of these events and said, "This event is fabulous and you're bursting at the seams. You need a bigger space." And so he offered one of the ballrooms at the Mohegan Sun, essentially donated this space because he recognized how important this event was to Connecticut families. So for the past 3 years, Lois and I have been co-organizers of this event. And the event brings together organizations, like I mentioned, in the community. We've invited 70 organizations from across the state of Connecticut that support individuals with disabilities from birth to age 21. And for the last 3 years, we have attracted 750 Connecticut families. And I think what's beautiful about this event is because we recognize that families need information and that information is hard to find, you know, LEARN in partnership with the Mohegan Sun and Lois and I and all of these organizations have brought together all of this information on one day and in one place for families to access it. And the response has been amazing. Unfortunately, in March 2020, so this year, we had to postpone the event because of, you know, things that have been going on. But we're really looking forward to bringing the event back because I think it is a way to combat, you know, some of this, the distance that families with children with disabilities feel.
That, of course, is all great. And whenever we can get access to information, of course, you know, that is a great thing. But do you think that as a society, that, you know, that we are still behind when it comes to matters and issues that affect people living with disability and, of course, their families? What is it that we're just not getting?
I think that's such a great question. It's a complicated question. I think there is not one organization or one person or one thing to blame. I think we are moving forward. I think as a society, we are moving forward and we're becoming more inclusive in that we're recognizing, you know, individuals with disabilities. And I know there are a lot of really great educators and a lot of great schools that are recognizing this and supporting students as well. You know, I think society and I think education are just really big, slow moving institutions. You know, because I work among really great educators, I know that people are working really hard to see individuals, but I think collectively, I think we, you know, as a society, see the group rather than seeing one person. And that can be hard when you're the one person who has a need that's different than someone else. So I think we are making progress, but I do think we have a little ways to go.
So it sounds like we are slowly getting it, but we're just not applying it correctly in an educational setting, obviously, for these students.
I think we are getting it, and I think we are applying, you know, supports and things that we need, but it's happening really slowly. You know, and I don't think there is, you know, a quick fix. I think, you know, it's been interesting seeing education kind of pivot, right? That's the buzzword in the last few months. And education being forced to support students in a different way. So I think this has been a great learning experience. But I think, unfortunately, you know, and research and statistics do show this, that even in the ways we've gone to online learning in the last few months, that students with disabilities are being disproportionately underserved.
You obviously speak to these students, you speak to these families as part of your job, and I'm sure as part of the research for this book. I mean, you know, were there any particular frustrations, particular comments that came from them that really resonated with you?
One of the things that families share with me is that they don't know what they don't know. Sometimes, you know, certainly families are, they know their child the best. You know, I know, you know, my daughter, I knew her the best. And, you know, when I raised some of my concerns with her academic progress, for her, it was back in second grade with her teachers, because the teachers didn't see what I saw, it was a struggle for me to have my voice heard. And so I think that's something that I hear resoundingly from families, is that they don't know how much power they really have. You know, and particularly in the educational systems, you know, I think some schools do a really great job of telling parents to have a voice and encouraging them to have a voice. But as parents, we don't know always, you know, the policy side of special education. We don't know the things that we can say or we should say, or even if those things will be valued. So that's something that families tell me a lot, is that they know their child and they know what their child needs, but they don't know, or they don't feel empowered, you know, to have a voice and to speak for that.
It almost seems like a case of, when it comes to dealing with people with disability, of course, we can often see if they have a physical disability, but of yes. course, when it comes yes. to the other disabilities, yes. mental health, etc., mm-hmm. the unseen side mm-hmm. to it, that's where we seem to struggle as a society, as organizations.
Absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. Yeah, those hidden disabilities can be really detrimental for students. I've sat at a meeting talking about one of my daughters, and the educators sitting around the table have said, well, she doesn't look like she has this disability. Are you sure she has it? And it hurts. As a parent, that really hurts to hear that. So, you know, I think you're right there. I think the physical and the more external disabilities are unfortunately more accepted by society, if that's the right word, or more acknowledged. And the disabilities that we can't see, but that students struggle with equally, are hard, I think, are harder to be supported.
I mean, because obviously, you know, we saw the introduction of the American Disabilities Act, which of course allows for things like access and yes. and opening up the world for people with physical disability. But again, we get yes. back to this point of the unseen disability. And, you know, if we don't see it, we don't acknowledge it.
Yep, you are absolutely right. You know, and as a society and educators, you know, need to be kind of asking those questions when someone is struggling, right? And not assuming that a struggle is a result of laziness or a result of not being motivated. And often we assume that when a child, you know, does have a hidden disability, that it's a result of their struggle is a result of their choice, because it's not apparent to us on the outside why someone might be struggling. So I think it really requires compassion and patience from, whether it's from family members, right? You know, as a parent, sometimes I'm not as patient as I'd like to be, but, you know, to really ask those questions and say, even if it's something that I can't see, that maybe to really search for the answer, you know, of why someone might be struggling.
Of course, the important thing is to have that communication, isn't it, at the end of the
Absolutely.
Day? I mean, do you also think it's a case of sometimes either educators or families or a combination of both are just a little bit scared to have that conversation because they're not quite sure how to?
Without a doubt. Yes, you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of conversations in society where we struggle to talk with people whose life experience we don't understand. And communication is so important. I think being humble and saying, you know, I don't understand your experience. That doesn't mean I don't respect it. It doesn't mean I don't acknowledge it. It just means I need help understanding it. So absolutely, yes, having conversations and letting someone know that we want to listen, that we're not going to talk over or dismiss someone's experience is really important.
Yeah, I mean, that's another thing that we see so much in society, isn't it? That I think people become concerned or scared to open their mouths and say something because they feel they're just either going to be ignored or spoken over. Yes. And then, you know, nothing changes.
Absolutely. Yes. Yep. And unfortunately, you know, I think students with disabilities have, you know, sometimes have had to struggle, right? Like a lot of people have had to struggle for a lot of different reasons. And sometimes that can be very defeating. And so that's something else I talk to students about, you know, when they enter college, that it's, in a way, it's like they're starting over. They have a fresh slate. And to try to, you know, while certainly recognizing their struggles of the past, but to try to, you know, look forward and to try to be optimistic and to try to put themselves out there again, because, you know, there are educators out there, you know, like myself and like so many others who really see students and will take the time to listen to them and can give them really positive and affirming experiences and relationships. So those educators are out there.
Jen, it's been great talking to you. We can't, of course, let you go without you telling us the name of the book and where we can get hold of it.
Great. So the book is called Sharing the Transition to College: Words of Advice for Diverse Learners and Their Families. And it's part of the Cautiously Optimistic series, which means there are more books coming, and you can find the book on Amazon.
That's absolutely great. Jen Sullivan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you ever so much for sharing with us your insights as both an educator, a coach, and also as a mother with a child with a learning disability as well. I'm sure the people who are listening to this interview will get so much out of it and at least know that there is indeed, as you say, information and people out there that they can speak to. Thank you ever so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been nice talking to you, Brian.
Green Valley Tree LLC is proud to sponsor Connecticut East This Week. Contact Green Valley Tree LLC for all your tree removal and plant health care needs and more. Find us at greenvalleytreeworks.com or call 860-234-4041.
Time now for a look at some of the other stories making the headlines in the region recently. Governor Lamont gave his annual State of the State address virtually this year due to COVID-19 restrictions. In his address, he thanked the people of the state for trusting him with the office for a second year. Lamont also sent his sincere gratitude to the state's nurses, doctors, caregivers, National Guard, and teachers, and the many essential workers on the front line in the fight against COVID-19. He bid good riddance to 2020, calling it the most challenging and humbling year of his life. Lamont said this year he will be working with tribal partners to modernise gaming in the state with sports betting and internet gambling, and working with the legislator on legalisation of marijuana. He said Connecticut was coming back and that more people and families were moving into the state than leaving it for the first time in a generation. United States Senator Richard Blumenthal visited the iconic Guard Arts Centre in New London recently to talk up the new $15 billion Save Our Stages Act relief package for theatres and entertainment venues across the country affected by COVID-19 closures. Blumenthal said the arts are important for everyone, especially the young.
If you think about your own childhood and about the special memories, especially during the holiday season, often it's coming to performances, concerts, dances, theater, with your family.
Also present were local elected officials and Steve Siegel, the Guard's executive director, who said the arts will play an important role in a post-COVID world.
We perform a very important civic responsibility, which I believe this theater and other theaters around the country will be called upon, and that is to heal the nation. We're going to be gathering people from all different backgrounds. They're going to be celebrating each other's common humanity and connectivity.
Since COVID-19, arts and entertainment venues have remained closed to comply with local social distancing and crowd size restrictions. The Save Our Stages movement saw over 2 million emails submitted to elected officials across the country asking for financial assistance from the federal government. In the Connecticut Examiner this week, Connecticut Health Policy Project Director weighs in on needed reforms. Ellen Andrews has served on over a dozen health policy committees in Connecticut. If it were up to her, they would all be eliminated. The best thing Connecticut could do is do away with all of its committees and boards and task forces, said Andrews. Andrews has been the director of the nonprofit Connecticut Health Policy Project, which publishes research and briefs about Connecticut healthcare policy since it was founded in 1999. She also serves on the State Medical Assistance Program Oversight Council, which advises on Connecticut's Medicare program, and the Healthcare Cabinet for the State Office of Health Strategy, which advises state officials on federal health reform policies. In her 25 years of experience, Andrews said she's watched as committees have taken on a different tone. What were once places for lively discussion about healthcare policy, presided over by a diverse group of members, doctors, individual consumers, appointments from both the Democrats and Republicans, over the last two administrations have been filled instead with people with fixed ideas of what the outcomes should be. Andrews said she has also noticed a conspicuous lack of advocates for ordinary consumers. In the day this week, State's Attorney Michael L. Regan, who has served as New London County's top prosecutor since 2006, is retiring at the end of the month. Regan, 66, a lifelong resident of New London, is one of thousands of state employees expected to retire prior to June 30, 2022, when an agreement between the state and its employee unions would result in lower cost of living increases and higher medical costs for retirees. He said by phone that he felt now was the right time to go. The state's attorney position has been advertised within the Division of Criminal Justice. Applications are due soon, and the Criminal Justice Commission is expected to interview applicants later in the month and appoint Reagan's replacement. In the Norwich Bulletin this week, a leader in Norwich's business community has gone missing, and a body meeting his description has been found in a river in West Virginia. Jason Vincent, president of the Norwich Community Development Corporation and a partner at Epicure Brewing, was reported missing to the Fayette County Dispatch in West Virginia on December 30th, according to National Parks Service Public Information Officer Leah Pekowski-Sisk. A body has since been recovered, matching Vincent's description, by the Hawks Nest River Dam. An official identification from the West Virginia State Medical Examiner's Office is still pending, but no foul play has been involved. It is still not known why Vincent was in West Virginia. His family has been notified by the authorities. In the Chronicle this week, local Wyndham nonprofit CLIC is a recipient of funding from a U.S. Department of Agriculture Rural Business Development grant program to support Latinx food businesses. The $34,000 grant provides 10 Bridge to Rural Success micro-business scholarships to low-income Latinx entrepreneurs in the Wyndham area to support initial startup costs of their own food businesses. The grant expands CLIC's outreach and engagement to the Latinx community by providing funding for interpretation, translation, and business support in Spanish to the new owners. CLIC is short for Commercially Licensed Cooperative Kitchen. And in next week's Connecticut East this week, we talk with Ari Santiago, president of IT Direct, a Connecticut-based IT solutions company and podcast host of Made in America, about the state of manufacturing here in Connecticut. And we speak with Mike Penta, owner of Waterford Fitness, about how we can all get healthy in 2021 despite COVID restrictions, and how we maintain a positive mindset if we can't get to a local gym. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East, where you can also listen to the show again on demand. And please like, follow, and share on your social media platforms too. I'm Brian Scott Smith. Thank you for listening.